A typical massive star ends its life in an explosive cataclysm of hot gas and radiation, called a supernova. Remnants of these dramatic deaths can linger on for thousands of years and be easily detected by professional astronomers. But one nearby supernova is practically invisible. Can astronomers solve the mystery of the shy supernova? Hi, I'm Linda Vu.
This Spitzer Space Telescope podcast is part of a series highlighting recent discoveries in infrared astronomy. It's produced by NASA's Spitzer Science Center at the California Institute of Technology in Pasadena. The Spitzer mission is managed by NASA's Jet Propulsion Laboratory.
Our guest today is Dr. Patrick Morris, a scientist at NASA's Herschel Science Center. For 2 years, Pat has been working to solve the mystery of the shy supernova, and recently published a paper on the topic in April's issue of Astrophysical Journal. Welcome, Pat.
Hello, Luna. Thank you.
Pat, could you start by telling us a little bit about what you found?
Sure. We think we've probably detected, for the very first time on its infrared properties alone, a supernova remnant, which is the material which is left over after a massive star explodes. And by massive, this is usually a star which is at least several times the solar mass of our own sun. In our case, we think we have one that's even more massive than that, at least 25 solar masses or higher. So these supernova remnants are fairly rare. There's only about 230, 235 of these known in the galaxy. Ours would add one more to that list. And based on what we've observed with the instruments on Spitzer, we think that a supernova remnant is really the best possibility for this particular object.
When you say 200 or 230, that's 200, 230 out of billions?
There's in the billions, yeah, it's in the billions. One of the things that makes these sorts of objects hard to detect, though, is the fact that there may be billions of stars in our galaxy, but there's really just the way that stars are born and evolve. There's not that many of them at high enough initial mass that they'll evolve and eventually collapse back down on themselves and then explode back outwards very violently. So it really is a question of population and statistics. It's demographics, let's say. There's just not a lot of really, really big stars that like to live fast and die young, and that's what happens in a supernova.
So when did you first detect this source?
We detected the source in December of 2003, and that was during the initial surveys that we did with the science instruments on Spitzer, the three science instruments, for the purposes of demonstrating that, in fact, the capability and potential to do good science with these instruments really was there. So we detected the source, but it took us about another 2 years to finally decide that we had a believable answer that other astronomers would believe us as well.
And had anyone ever detected the source before?
No. Spitzer was the very first instrument to do it. In fact, it almost escaped Spitzer's detection because there are two cameras on board, as you know. There's the multiband imaging photometer for Spitzer that has three filters on it, three long wavelength filters, and the infrared array camera, which has four shorter wavelength filters. And only one of those filters did we actually see the supernova remnant of the shell, let's say, itself. The other six filters showed up almost nothing. Anything that we could believe was actually there. So that was a puzzle to us right away.
So did you ever think that this could maybe be an anomaly with the instrument?
Actually, we did. That's a very good question, because when you're in your early survey mode, you're kind of operating the instrument in kind of a rough and ready fashion. You want to cover a big piece of the sky as quickly as you can and get your data down and practice, you know, looking at the data, checking out the performance of the instrument, doing your data processing and so forth. And who knows where any of that could come. It could have been in the data processing. There's at least one really bright star nearby, and it does produce what we call memory effects in some of the data, where every time you move to a different position on the sky, you can still see the residual of that star that you looked at from that previous position. And we were a little bit worried, but not for very long, that that might be an instrument effect. But it didn't look like any kind of instrument effect that an instrument scientist would understand. But you had to rule it out. The way that we convincingly rule it out then was to look at that same object with a third instrument called the infrared spectrograph at a completely different time. This was done several months later. And once we saw the signatures of that object in our spectrograph, which doesn't have the same susceptibility as the cameras do, we knew right away this was not an instrument effect. We would like to have better quality data, of course, but at least the quality of the data at that time were really, really good. So
Spitzer did it on its first try.
We basically got a discovery on its first try, and that's what's great about the first look survey.
Usually it's because of the dust, the material exploding from the dying star, crashing to the dust that causes all this noise.
Yeah.
Why is it that Spitzer can see this without much dust around the area?
This, again, was answered by the IRS. When IRS looks at something, what it does is it breaks that light down in much greater detail. And what that does is it reveals to us what kind of chemistry is present, how much dust versus gas is present, and immediately it told us that there was really only oxygen gas being detected by MIPS alone. And so it really took the IRS to solve that part of the problem, and that was done in follow-up observations, not part of the actual survey itself.
So it kind of reminds me of that old philosophical question about if a tree falls in the woods and nobody's around to hear it, did it really fall? Did the supernova really explode?
Yeah, that's a good question. I guess the way you would approach that as an observational scientist is that you don't know anything about what's out there until you actually observe it. It's an awfully big sky out there, so there are plenty of theories based on the observational evidence we have already and what we know about stellar evolution, the number of stars out there that are big enough to have supernova explosions, about how many we should expect in our galaxy. It's just kind of a population statistical argument. But actually finding one of these things is the way you see where the tree has fallen. So you could easily say, sure, there are plenty of fallen trees, but where are they at? How big are they? You know, how long have they been laying there? That's what you need observational astronomy for.
Do you think that there are other ones out there above the dusty disk that we haven't detected
yet? It would make complete sense, but that's the other interesting aspect about our work, is that until you actually find one of these, do you have constraints on how you might go about looking for them, or what you might expect, or let's say the reason why they're hard to detect to begin with. If you're out there in a kind of a empty ISM, let's say, there's not much out there you're going to see for it to run into, and if it's that far away, it's going to be fairly small as well. So you do need sensitive instruments to detect it.
So ISM meaning interstellar medium.
The interstellar medium, that's right. It's the material between the stars themselves. And it's not just the material in the disk of our galaxy where most of the stars live, but also above it and below it as well.
Why is this finding significant?
Just from the standpoint of the instrument scientist, and I used to be an instrument scientist here with the infrared spectrograph, now I'm playing with other spectrographs on the Herschel Space Observatory, that this thing really was playing hide and seek with our instruments. And to use all three instruments together to solve at least an observational puzzle is really a lot of fun. It's scientifically extremely interesting because if it is a supernova remnant, this would be the very first one detected first by its infrared properties alone.
So it sounds like you've solved the mystery of the Shy supernova.
If it is indeed a supernova remnant, and this is our best scenario, then it of course is one of the smallest in the galaxy because it's so far away, and it's also one of the youngest. It's only about 1,000 years old.
So what other hobbies do you have besides hunting for supernova?
Well, that was not a hobby until we found this one. But besides helping to build instruments and having shot into space on the most powerful rockets in the world, I like to watch my little guy play baseball and take him rock climbing and that sort of thing.
Is he interested in astronomy at all? Do you think he's a future astronomer?
Oh, man, yeah, he sure is. He's very interested in it. He goes to school and talks about it all the time, and I think his teachers are even afraid of him, and he's only 8 years old now, so.
Well, thanks for joining us today.
Yeah, my pleasure. Thank you.
Today we've been speaking with Dr. Patrick Morse of the Herschel Science Center. For the Spitzer Science Center, I'm Linda Vu.
To find out more about this topic, visit our website at www.spitzer.caltech.edu. You can browse our image galleries, read about the latest results, and subscribe to our newsletter. On behalf of NASA's Spitzer Science Center, thanks for listening.